Good morning. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Happy to have you along with us today. Larry is still up in Door County after a very successful remote yesterday at the Peninsula Players Theater. And, of course, the topic that they talked about was cherries. With me here is one of our cherries, Dick Zondag, president of the Jung Seed Company in Randolph, Wisconsin. Dick, it's always a pleasure to see you.
Yeah, I hope I'm a sweet cherry and not one of those tart cherries that you put in pies.
I noticed that in the Jung catalog, we've got tasty sweet cherries, we've got pie cherries. Which of them is the not-so-sweet?
Well, the pie cherries are a little bit on the tart side because that's the way they grow. Although when you pick them off the tree, they're not so tart you can't eat them, but they're heartier too. And so the tart pie cherries are the ones that are really best suited for Wisconsin climates. And the other advantage to the tart cherries is that they're self-fruitful. You only have to have one tree to make them bear. The sweet cherries, although we have some varieties that are what I call zone 5, which means it's sort of borderline for this area, you have to have two different kinds to cross-pollinate. And so, you know, if you're going to put in a sweet cherry, you've got to put in two different kinds, where if you're putting in a Montmorency or one of the Meteor, which is a great tart cherry, you can put in one tree and you'll have fruit. The other thing, you know, in Door County, they have so many cherries that the birds can't eat them all, and so they get nice crops. And if you've got a cherry tree sitting out in the middle of nowheres and it gets ripe, if you haven't got the tree netted, the birds will descend on them and will devour the cherry. So although I don't discourage people from planting cherries, they're a little bit of work, and so. But I tell you, those cherries are really good too, because you can pick them and pit them, and then freeze them for use in almost any kind of a pastry or a pie, and they're really good.
Dick Zondag, our guest, and if you'd like to join this Garden Talk conversation, the number for you in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, toll free at 800-642-1234. The lines are full, so let's take some calls, and we'll start with Chuck in Montford. And Chuck, what's on your mind today?
Good morning, gentlemen. Thanks for having me on, Jim. Mm-hmm. Appreciate it. I have a question about fruit trees. We'd like to plant a small orchard, and we live in southwestern Wisconsin, Grant County. My question one is, are there peach trees that would be conducive to this climate? Because that's one of the fruit trees we'd like to plant.
Yeah, peach trees, you're getting to the area where they're really very borderline. What I recommend is that there are some varieties that are hardier than others. One is called the Reliance peach, and the other is called the Madison peach. And my recommendation to people that are living in areas where it's kind of borderline is to buy one peach tree, because peaches, again, are self-fruitful. They're not like apples or pears or plums. You don't need two different varieties to get the fruit to stick. And so what you do is plant one tree and see how it does. If you get fruit on it, then I would go ahead and maybe put a couple more in. But if you're planting just a few trees and you want to have fruit on all the trees, peaches are a real gamble. The two problems with peaches is, number one, the fruit buds on the tree are a little bit susceptible to winter damage. So if you're getting a lot of freezing and thawing or some extreme cold, the flower buds will disappear. The tree usually is hardy, but the flower buds are the problem. The other problem with peaches is that if we get the combination of a very early spring where it warms up in late March, early April to some really, for a long time, like 2 or 3 weeks, peaches will tend to blossom very early. And then if you get the other part of it, with a hard frost, it will also take the fruit off. So you got two strikes against you with peaches. But on the other hand, if you've ever had a tree-ripened peach compared to the green ones that you get in the store, they are really good.
Oh, so, yeah, I agree. It's worth the risk, yeah. I think, you know. What time of year do you plant fruit? Like peaches, apples, cherries, pears? These are all things we'd like to plant, and do you plant those all at the same time of the year?
Yes. The best time is in the springtime. As soon as the frost disappears out of the soil and excess moisture is moved through so that you can plant them, The best time then is to get them bare root and plant them that time. You can plant them any time during the summer or fall if you can find potted trees, which we have in our garden centers. But the best time is to plant them in spring, because then you get a growing season, so they're established before they have to go through a winter. But if you can find them potted, you know, planting them at this time of the year, they'll have a chance to establish. And then mulching them after the soil gets cool, not cold, but after the soil gets cool, will also help them establish during the wintertime.
Would that be the same? Would the same be true then for maple trees? Would you plant those in the spring too? Our thought is to possibly plant some sugar maples for syrup.
Yeah, the best time is in the spring. But as I said, if you can find them bald and burlapped or in pots, you can plant them anytime during the growing season.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the information.
All right, Chuck, thank you very much for the call. Appreciate hearing from you. And now to Mary in Galesville. Hello, Mary.
Hello. I had a question for Mr. Zondag. I purchased some blackjack sedums this spring. And when I got them, they had some little tan spots in the leaves, and I thought maybe they had gotten nipped by frost, but now it's kind of spreading to more of the plant. And I'm wondering if you know what that is.
That particular perennial has darker leaves than the regular green. Are there holes in them? Or
No, it's just kind of a tan discoloration, mostly on the edges of the leaves.
Okay. What I would suggest, it sounds to me, if it's sort of a tan discoloration, it might be a nutrient deficiency.
Oh.
What I would do is maybe fertilize them with a soluble plant food like muriacid or something like that that has a good minor nutrient load.
Okay.
And if that doesn't help, I guess the thing that we would like customers to do is to send some leaves in.
Okay.
You know, just take a couple of leaves off and put them in a paper towel that's not soaking wet, but has a little bit of moisture in, so that they don't disappear in the mail, and then just send them to customer service. And
if
they can identify it, they do it, and if not, they bring it up to me, and we try to try to find out what the problem is.
All right. Well, terrific. I'll do that then.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mary. Appreciate your call as we talk with Dick Zondag, president of the Jung Seed Company in Randolph, Wisconsin. Dick, in Wednesday's edition of the Wall Street Journal, writer Steve Stecklow has a story called War of the Roses, Beetle versus Nematode, his personal battles against the Japanese beetle. The insect, of course, arrived in New Jersey nearly as long as Jung Seed Company had been around, about 100 years ago, and now spread its havoc on the foliage of fruit and ornamental trees, shrubs, vines, and vegetables in more than 30 states, including Wisconsin.
Yeah, it's a voracious eater. I went to school on the East Coast, and we used to get Japanese beetle invasions, and they can completely defoliate plants in very little time. There are a couple ways that you can attack them. They are very susceptible to most insecticides like malathion. The one that we recommend is 8, which is a synthetic pyrethroid, and that will knock them down really good. But there are some long-term ones for your yard. There's a product called Milky Spore. Not inexpensive, but what you do is you inoculate the soil with the Milky Spore, because what you're going after is the larvae. They form a larvae that resides in the soil for a while. Mm-hmm. And what happens is the spore gets into the larvae and kills the larvae. And if you do this a couple years in a row, the soil will build up in this Milky Spore. So you only have to do it 2, maybe 3 years. And then what happens is the spore will build up in the bodies of these larvae. And then as they die, the spores will reproduce. And so if you get another borer coming in there, or another larvae of that particular insect, it will attack the larvae and kill it. So there's also the traps that you can use. You want to put them... I always have to think about this. You want to put them upwind of the plants that you're trying to protect, so it pulls them out of the plants that you're protecting. For instance, the roses, so it doesn't attract all the neighborhood ones into your yard too. So it's not an easy situation, and they are spreading. I mean, the East Coast has had them forever, and they're starting to get into the Midwest now, and we're seeing more and more of them. So the traps, the insecticide would be 8. or if you want to go for the long-term thing, the milky spore, a couple of years in a row, and you just follow the instructions on the packages, of course, so that you don't misuse the things that you have. But, you know, we're starting to get more and more of these insects.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the Japanese beetle, you know, we've done some reading on it, and it seems like the Japanese beetle in its homeland in Japan only has a few plants that it attacks. But it seemed like once it got here, it tasted the U.S.'s great gourmet, I guess you'd say, of plants. And so here, it just seems like it'll attack almost anything. But roses for sure, and I think probably roses because the most roses have a fragrance to it which attracts the beetles, although I'm just surmising that. I'm not... You know, I've done some entomology courses, but I'm just surmising that because the roses do have the fragrance, and that may be what's attracting them, but it seems like the roses are the first place they go.
Off to Larry in Iowa County next. Hi, Larry.
Oh, hi, Jim. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
A couple quick questions about asparagus.
Okay.
First, how long can we expect the beds to be productive? And secondly, I'm kind of wondering about how one would go about fertilizing them if they should be fertilized, and I would use only some natural form of fertilizer.
Right. The asparagus patches, once you get them established, that would be probably a couple of years, should last as long as you or I do, because they're a long-lived plant. They don't like to be disturbed once they're established, though. So if you've got an established plant and you want to take them along, you probably won't be able to do that. So once you establish them, you have to leave them where they are. Good old cow manure, I guess, is the best kind of fertilizer that you can use if you're using organic fertilizer. Asparagus is one of the vegetables that you can fertilize quite heavily because the part that you're eating is a vegetative part of the plant, and so you can fertilize it pretty well. With most plants, if you fertilize too heavily, you don't eat the vegetative part of the plant, the leaf and the stem part of the plant. And so if you do that, what tends to happen is, like with beans or tomatoes, you get huge plants, but they never go to fruit.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be careful of what you do with those. But with asparagus, you can even use fresh manure on them, and the nitrogen and the different plant-growing substances that are in it will help your asparagus grow.
You just put the fertilizer right on top of the bed?
Right on top of the soil. And see, with most beds that you want to keep for a long period of time, depending on your soil type, can go 8 to 12 inches deep, and that way they're less susceptible to winter damage.
Mm-hmm. Good. Thank you very much.
All right, Larry, thank you very much. Again, our telephone number for you to join this garden talk in Madison is 263-1890 or 1-800-642-1234, as we talk with Dick Zondag, president of the Jung Seed Company. Let's go to Frank in Madison next for our next call. Hi, Frank.
Yes, good morning. Question about daylilies.
Okay.
About a month or 5 weeks ago, we had daylilies galore. They were so numerous that it was almost difficult to count them.
Right.
Then they finally dissipated, and now for, maybe a week or more than that, all we have are long stems with a nodule on top.
Right.
And I don't know where future blossoms are going to come from.
You're probably not going to get future blossoms. Daylilies, although there are a few repeat bloomers, most of the time daylilies are one-time bloomers.
Oh.
And so those sticks with the nodules on top, what you're seeing is the seed pods forming.
Yeah, right.
And so, you know, if you're not interested in growing seeds to try to provide new varieties, the best thing to do is to cut those stalks back to where the leaves are, and that way the plant won't be throwing any of its energy into the making of the seed.
Uh-huh.
It won't hurt them, especially if they're established plants, to do that, but some people just like to have them looking more formal, and they don't like those flower stalks sticking up. But that, once in a while, if you do that, once in a while, if you cut the flower heads off, if it's a reblooming type daylily, it will throw another set of blossoms. But with 95% of the varieties, they bloom once a year, and that's it.
Oh, I see. Well, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yep.
That's disappointing to hear.
Well,
that.
Well, it is disappointing, but boy, I tell you, our daylily fields are in full bloom right now, and it is just glorious. You can't. We're growing mainly the tetraploids now, although we have a few diploids left. But the color is just extreme. I mean, the flower, a field of daylilies is just almost indescribable.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you've got the reds and the golds and the salmon colors and the light yellows.
Regular yellow ones.
Yep, and yellow ones too. Yeah. So it's really pretty.
Oh, you know, it seems as though last year we went through a period like this, and then we did start getting some more blossoms.
Well, then what I would say is cut those back, because they may...
When you say cut them back, you mean those long stems?
Right. That's called the scape. That's the flower stalk. And what I would do is probably cut it back to where the leaves hide it. You don't have to go all the way back to the ground with it. What you're basically doing is taking the seed off. And sometimes they'll throw out another flower stalk. The other thing you want to do, too, is if the daylilies have been in for a few years and you've got quite large clumps, now is the time that you want to renewal prune them. And what you do is you take a sharp shovel and you stick it right down in the middle of the clump, and you dig half the clump out.
Oh.
And then that kind of revitalizes them, too.
I see. Okay.
All right. Frank, thanks very much for your call. Appreciate hearing from you on this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. Welcome to Garden Talk. I'm Jim Packard, in for Larry Mueller, and with me in studio is Dick Zondag, president of the Jung Seed Company in Randolph, Wisconsin. And we're taking your calls today on this edition of Garden Talk. Elaine is next in Richland Township. Hello, Elaine.
Hi. Well, I would like to share some of my perennials,
okay,
which means digging up part of them. So when is the best time to do that, and what is the best way? I have mostly Rudbeckia and Shasta daisies and Echinacea,
okay,
and Heliocallis lilies.
Okay. The Hemerocallis are the daylilies, and with daylilies, now is the time. Right after they're done blossoming, now is the time to do that. With most of the other perennials, especially with the coneflowers, the Echinops, the Echinacea, excuse me, the time to do that is probably in another 3 or 4 weeks or early in the spring before they start out. And as a rule of thumb with most perennials, one of the better times is to do it in the springtime, right after the soil thaws out, the excess moisture has moved through, but before the plants have really started to put a lot of growth on. But if you're going to do it in the fall, you want to do it not when they're in real heavy bloom, because that usually is a pretty vigorous time, and when plants are not semi-dormant, they don't transplant very well. But the springtime is really the time to do it.
Okay.
The problem with doing it in the fall is the plants have to be start establishing the root system before the winter sets in, or you have to mulch them quite heavily in probably mid-October so that they don't get frost heaved out of the ground. So you can do it in the late summer, early fall after the plants have kind of gone into a quiescent period, but the very best time in Wisconsin is probably early spring.
I'll wait until spring. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Elaine. Appreciate your call. On to Bob in Westfield next. Hello, Bob.
Hello. Question and a comment. A question I have here is, now, we put in about an acre and a half garden, and we start all of our own plants from seed. The last couple of years, the germination rate on vegetables more than flowers has just been all over the place. And I'm wondering if you've noticed this, or is this a common problem, or?
Boy, we hear this once in a while, but we do have a germination lab in the company, and every lot of seed, whether it's coming in new or whether it's held over, is germ tested to make sure that it meets the standards that, in fact, that usually above the standards that are set by the USDA for seed germination. I guess with plants, especially plants that you start indoors, be sure that you're using a sterile medium like Jiffy Mix, or, you know, most garden centers have a sterile starting mix, because especially with the smaller seeded things, if you don't start with a sterile mix, you're starting out with two strikes against you. The damping off of microorganisms, the Rhizoctonia and the Pythium, can come in through any kind of garden soil that you use, or they can come in the water, and that's why using the sterile medium really helps. Boy, I really don't know what else to tell you on that. We try to have the best possible seed that we can provide, and if we have a lot of seed that is close to meeting the standards or below the standards and we can't replace it or get new seed for it, what we do is we overpack so that even though the seed may be at or a little below standards, we give you a lot more seed than what, you know, we say we'll provide in a package so that you get the right amount of plants for what you're purchasing.
Sure, yeah. You know, and we get seed from all over the place, including from Jung's, and we use bottom heat when we start them, and we're using potting soil, and they start them in the basement, they go out in the greenhouse.
But potting soil is not the same as starting soil.
Well, starting soil, I should say. I do use Jiffy Mix for starting. I was just curious. This is about the last two, 3 years I've noticed this, and it just, I don't know if I'm the only one who's had this problem or...
Well, I guess I could go back and check with the germ lab and see once. You know, we don't... Because of our short growing season and because the seed business is kind of stratified into a two-layered business, we grow very little of the seed that we sell. We depend on the other level plant seed people that have migrated to areas like the West Coast or overseas where they have a longer growing season that we have. And so they produce the new varieties and grow the seed. And then we buy the seed from them and repackage it. But what we do is we have a test garden that we test the seed in our area so that even though the seed isn't grown in our area, it has been tested under our climatic conditions. So it should do well for people that live in a cold climate or and they have a short growing season. And we do have our own germ lab where we test every lot of seed that comes in to make sure that it meets those standards. You know, it's we try to be as reputable and as good to our customers as we possibly can.
Or do with something. But now I was just wondering. The other thing I was going to say, the last couple, 2 years I've been growing these Cossack kohlrabis. By the way, Jung's is about the only place I've ever found the seed for them. If anybody likes kohlrabi, you got to try these. These things are fantastic. Yeah. I mean, I've grown them as big as a basketball and ate woody a bit.
You know, that particular variety is it's sort of an open pollinated thing, but it's as you said, you can eat them as a small kohlrabi, or you can grow them up to a large size. I don't think I've ever seen one the size of a basketball, but I've seen them pretty large, and they just you cut into them, and you don't find that woody center that some of them when you're when you're growing them, if you let them get a little too big, they do get woody. So, yeah, that particular variety is very good.
Yeah, then things are great. Well, thank you.
All right, Bob, thank you very much. Appreciate hearing from you in Westfield. And if you'd like to join in, the number for you in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. And let's go next to Lori in Bayside. Hello, Lori. How are you today?
Oh, I'm just fine. I wanted to know what percentage of the plants in the Jung Nursery are native plants?
That's a pretty hard question to answer because what happens with a lot of the native plants is people will select them or they'll hybridize them so that you get an improvement on the native plants. So, for instance, the coneflower can be a native species on the prairie, but they've crossbred and inbred and rebred, and so they come up with different colors. And so the ancestry of the plant is it's a native, but because of all the hybridizing and things that's gone on to produce the new varieties and things like that, is it native or isn't it native? You know, the initial germs were native, but... they've been bred so much. We do have a few of the native things in the catalog. Because we're a department store type catalog, we try to stick to things that really do well in the garden for our customers. And, you know, if you want native plants, there are nurseries that do specialize in just native material.
I so appreciate that in Wisconsin. I'm a member of the Wild Ones, and the first Saturday in August, the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center has a bus tour that goes to 20 different yards,
right.
And the front yards are planted with native plants.
Right.
And there's always the question of, you know, where can we get our native plants? And that was the reason I asked.
Well,
and I listened to the program the
right.
hour before this, and I was unable to get through on the line. But I was appalled by the paucity of ideas of what you could do to replace your lawn, or at least make it smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And there weren't enough choices, and it was just so, just pure serendipity that.
There are a lot of
tour should be by the Schlitz Audubon Center
right.
to really have people get ideas on to how they can put native perennials in their front yards.
Yeah. Well, I know Neil DeVoe really well from Prairie Nurseries, I think.
Yes.
Was in Plainfield,
mm-hmm.
that is an expert in prairie plants, and he really does a great job. And so, you know, if you're looking for nursery, you know, for a nursery or for a seed source for strictly native plants, I mean, Prairie Nurseries in Plainfield, Neil DeVoe has got a really nice little business there. And, you know, we don't disregard the prairie, you know, the native plants, but it seems like our customers don't want to pay prairie plants are not inexpensive. I mean, they're mm-hmm. the seeds and things like that to do a quarter acre or a third acre or a half acre is pretty expensive. And because most of those plants have to go, quite a few of them are biennials, or you have to burn to keep the non-native species from coming in. I know there are lots of different things to do. It's kind of a niche type thing. And you see a lot of native yards, so to speak. And there are people that plant, if they've got an acre or so, they'll plant a prairie in the back of their yards, and they really take good care of it. But that is sort of a niche business. And although we have those types of seeds in our garden centers, I don't think we have them in the catalog anymore, because we do square inch analysis. We are a for-profit business, and it really didn't pay, because people would see that it costs a couple hundred dollars to do a quarter acre of native prairie, and they just
didn't want to go in that direction.
So, but there are specialized nurseries out there, and I'm sure if you Google prairie plants for Wisconsin, you'll find plenty of sources.
Lori knows very well where they all are. And Lori, thank you so much. We appreciate the work that you do with the Wild Ones. On to Pat in East Troy. Hi, Pat.
Hi there. Thank you so much for taking my call. I've been waiting with bated breath for somebody to help me. I've spent the last 3 days knocking down a 5-foot-high burning pile that consisted of oak and maple leaves principally, and branches, and building materials that were no longer needed, and had some lots of rusty iron hardware embedded in them that now I'm trying to pick out with a magnet. But I would like to be able to plant over this spread-out ash residue, and I need to know what I have to do to amend that soil to make it useful.
Yeah, see, when you burn something on the soil, it tends to burn some of the organic matter off, too. So what type of soil do you have? Is it sand or silt or clay?
A combination of mostly clay, but the top layer formerly was farmland, so it seems to be black. I think we always called it topsoil.
Right. I guess what I would do, like you said, is get rid of all the iron, because that's going to be a hazard for people, you know, when they work in the garden. Especially if it's nails and things like that. So get all of the iron out. But then what I would do is, if you've got a town in the area, get a load of leaves in the fall and just make a pile of leaves on that area. Now, how quickly do you want to do this?
Oh, within my lifetime.
Oh, okay. So it's not something you want to do tomorrow.
No.
Okay, if you were going to do it tomorrow, it's different than if you're doing it in your lifetime. I would get a load of leaves and then mix some fertilizer in those leaves. You know, if you've got a way of grinding them up a little bit so that they're not just the leaves, and then mix some fertilizer in, which will make the microorganisms in the leaves and in the soil work on that. and compost them, and then add that, work it into the top 8 inches to a foot, and then I get in trouble when I talk about pesticides on public radio, but what I would do then is work it into the soil next spring and then wait and see what weeds come up. And if you've got a lot of perennial weeds like quackgrass or thistles or things that are there, I'd hit them with Roundup, because Roundup is... Yeah, it takes care of, you know, it's translocated into the root system and kills the roots that are in the ground. And then wait a week, because it takes about a week for it to do what it's going to do. And then work the soil up again and see if there's any regrowth. If there's regrowth, hit them again. Because sometimes in areas that you haven't grown things in a while, there will be rhizomes in the ground that will not have green above ground, and it has to be translocated. And if they start growing again, then I'd hit them once more, and then wait a week and then work it up and then start planting. If it's a large area, put the plants in far enough apart so they have room to grow, and then mulch between them with an organic mulch. That way it'll keep the weeds from coming up, and we'll add organic matter to the soil, and do that over a period of time, and you'll have a beautiful garden.
Oh, thank you. That's a great relief, and I will take my time to do it. I have one more question.
And what is that?
Do you have any suggestions about something that I can put on or do to my potted annuals that I have would like to have around the yard and on my deck to keep the darn little chipmunks out?
Oh.
They get in there, and they're ruining everything.
Moth crystals, dried blood, tobacco dust. Those are the... three things, and then, no, I'm not going to say shotgun.
That's yeah, right. He didn't
those are repellent. No, I just have to control myself a little bit, I guess.
I appreciate that. Yeah,
there are traps that you can use too, where you can trap the chipmunks, you know, using peanut butter or some other kind of, I think, even carrots and things like that, and then take them to a more wild area. But the moth crystals, just put them on top of the soil and then put a little mulch over them. That naphthalene does give off an odor and does repel them, or tobacco dust or dried blood. Those three things really work fairly good.
Oh, thank you. What a relief.
All right, Pat. Good luck to you. Thanks very much for your call. Yesterday when Larry was in Door County talking about the cherry business, the grower that he had on the air said that they have success with dangling a bar of soap, of a deodorant soap,
right,
from each of the cherry trees,
right,
to keep the deer away.
What you do is you collect these little bars of soap that you have when you're in the motel, you know, and take them along home, and then you just leave them wrapped, because you don't want the rain to wash all the soap away, but you just leave them wrapped. You just drill a hole through them, and then just put a string through them and tie them in the trees. And what it really is the perfume, the soap scent and the perfume scent, the deer will sense that, and they'll think there are humans in the area, and that will keep them away. But yeah, that works pretty good with deer and other large animals. I never tried it with chipmunks, but maybe that would work with them too.
Dick Zondag is our guest from the Jung Seed Company. We're on to Brent next in La Crosse. Hello, Brent.
Morning. I got a couple questions about the seed business, like the other caller.
Sure.
Had a couple back. But before I ask, I'd just like to say that my grandfather and father have been loyal customers to Jung's, and I am too, up to a certain extent. I jumped headfirst into market gardening about 7 years ago.
Okay.
And I still use your catalog as a reference. It's one of the few I do keep, just because I know what you offer in your catalog is hardy and prolific in this area. My question is about some of the seed,
okay,
crop failures. One that gave me a problem this year was the, I think it's Jade Cross hybrid.
Yeah.
Why, is there only one farm that grows it, or a licensing problem? Why?
Well,
I couldn't get any this year at all.
Yeah, see, the seed business, as I explained to that other person, is kind of stratified into your retail-oriented and your production-oriented companies. And, for instance, with Jade Cross, there probably are only one or two companies in the world that produce that seed. And if they both have crop failures, then you have a crop failure. with, and so what we try to do to kind of rectify that situation is we'll have probably a year and a year and a half or a year and a third's worth of seed on hand when we start a season, so that we're not as exposed to those crop failures as most companies. But there are certain times when a particular seed like Jade Cross, I know that Sanibel cabbage a few years ago was a real problem, where the hybrids are one particular company's property, and they're the only producer, and they have a crop failure. If you don't have some of the seed from last year left over, you're really hurting. So where the genetics are closely held by one company, and it's getting to be more and more that way, because companies like Monsanto and Santos, and there are several, maybe two or three other companies that are eating up all the little producers all over the world. And so, you know, for instance, the company that we buy a lot of our seed from is called Seminess, and that's a Monsanto company. And they control the genetics for a particular good variety. They're the only one we can get it from. And if we have if they have a crop failure and we get prorated or we get no seed from them, then we're really in a tight straits. And problem is that's probably one of the premier companies in the world as far as producing new and better varieties. So that's what the problem is.
Okay. I think everybody ran out, because I'd call a company and say, DME from last year, and they'd say no. But next question is on catalogs. I do a little bit of business out of HPS.
Okay.
But I was wondering, with the growing popularity of market gardening and organic gardening, mm-hmm. market farming, I was wondering if you were thinking of adding a new catalog to your portfolio, such as Johnny's or Stokes or Harris,
actually,
the East Coast companies.
Yeah. I am the principal owner of Jung Seed Company because it was my grandfather's, and I inherited a lot of the things. We actually have nine different catalogs now, of which HPS is one. That's our roadside market wholesale, semi-wholesale catalog. My emphasis right now, because I'm getting to the point where I want to start slowing down, is to get the company in better financial shape, so that when my son, who just joined the business last year, gets in the driver's seat, he'll have a company that's in great financial shape. And those companies are, I mean, I'm not saying Johnny's or some of those other companies are for sale, but from time to time that they do come up for sale. And not going to tell you. I mean, there have been several companies in the last year that have called wanting to know if I wanted to buy them. And I'm not in the market to grow Jung Seed Company any more than it is.
Last request. Can you send a rep down to the organic conference in La Crosse next year?
There might be a possibility of doing that, because we are trying to do a better job with the markets that we're trying to fulfill. And one of the markets that we're looking at is the smaller roadside market people. And I guess what you should do, my email address is dick@jungseed.com. If you got information on things that you think would be beneficial, just send me that, and we'll try to especially if it's in the Middle West, which is where our main market is right now.
Yep. Like I said, I keep only about three catalogs of all the ones I receive, and one of them is Jung's.
Well, we appreciate that, because we try to do our best.
Brent, thank you very much for your call. We appreciate that. This is Garden Talk, and you're listening to Dick Zondag, president of the Jung Seed Company in Randolph, Wisconsin. You can see what they do at jungseed.com for their website. I'm Jim Packard, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network, and glad to have you along with us for another edition of Garden Talk. We've been talking about blackjack sedums and asparagus, daylilies, germination rates for seeds, native plants, soil burning, and we'd be happy to take your topic as well. You can join us in Madison at 263-1890 or toll-free at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Jessa in Madison next. Hi.
Hello. I was hoping that you could talk about changing the pH level in your soil organically.
Are you trying to acidify or trying to lower the pH, lower or raise the pH?
Well, I'm trying to do both, actually, because there's some blueberries that I wanted to plant, and then there were some other things that I wanted to make a little bit more neutral.
Okay, so, well, with our soils, they're basically neutral to maybe a little bit on the basic side, which is bad for blueberries. Organically, the way you do it is with the soil sulfur. You want to get it finely divided so that it breaks down relatively fast. Even in a non-organic way of doing blueberries, what I recommend to people is that they use aluminum sulfate for the rapid souring of the soil, and then they put the soil sulfur in. Both of those are naturally occurring. I don't know whether the aluminum sulfate would be as organic as the soil sulfur, but what happens with the soil sulfur is that the microorganisms in the soil first turn it to sulfite and then to sulfate. And, of course, iron sulfate is another way that you can acidify soils. Some people will add pine needles to their soil to try to acidify it, but you have to add a lot of pine needles to do anything because soils are what are called buffered systems. They tend to return to where they were, and because Wisconsin sits on a big piece of limestone and the water has a lot of bicarbonates in it, it tends to go back to the basic side because of all the water, you know, both the groundwater and because of the water that you water with. So, and I tell them every 5 years they should put a cup full of soil sulfur around their blueberries because that will keep the soil acid. If you want to make the soil basic, it's lime, and lime is a naturally occurring substance, so I would imagine that that's as organic as you can get too. One of the things you can also do is, and organic gardeners know this, is keep adding organic matter to the soil. You do your composting, add your compost to the soil, and that will help make nutrients more available. By having the organic matter in the soil, it traps more of the nutrients and keeps some more of the nutrients in the root zone area so that more nutrients are available to the plant. And so, you know, by doing those, I subscribe to the organic thing. I do as much organic in my garden as possible because I don't like to use a lot of pesticides and things either. But I guess in my view, if there's a problem that you can rectify with a pesticide and it's something that, you know, is going to keep my garden from being eaten up by insects and stuff, I do it. So, but I do a lot of organic things. I compost a lot. I add that to the soil, and I try to avoid. You know, there are ways of avoiding things by using mulches, by using black plastic, by putting paper around the stems of the tomatoes so that you don't have to go after the clipper, the insect that chews them off at the ground line. I mean, there are a lot of good organic ways to avoid situations with diseases, you know, which are getting to be a real problem with all the wet weather we've had. You spread your plants out a little farther so they dry out in the early morning sunlight, and then you don't have the spores getting into the leaves before the dew is dried off, where you try to pack as much as you can into an area where one plant is shading another. The dew stays around long, and the way a disease works is the spore shoots out a little germ tube, and if the dew stays on too long, that germ tube gets into the leaf, you got the disease. Where if your plants are spaced out so they're not so crowded, you get wind circulation in the morning sunlight so the dew dries off, you have less trouble with diseases. So there are a lot of organic things that you can do to avoid disease and insect problems. But, you know, and I do that, but I, you know, also have those tools at my disposal and I do use them.
Okay, well, thank you for taking my call.
All right, Jessa, thank you very much for your call. And on to Irma in Rice Lake. Hello, Irma.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning. My question is on clematis. I have two questions. The first one, squirrels in, how can I prevent the squirrels from breaking off my begonias when I have them in pots?
I guess the thing that we talked about a couple minutes ago is to use some of the the repellents, the moth crystals, the dried blood, and the tobacco dust. And there are products out there which blend them together, and you just put that on the soil, or if you can get dried blood. Jim mentioned the soap. You know, maybe shave a little bit of a very highly perfumed soap onto the top. Maybe that will discourage them.
Okay.
You know, anything that will make them feel that they're human or dog presence. You know, I know in my own yard, we've never had dogs in our family until my kids started getting off on their own, and now we have dogs around the house, and it seems like we have less problem with rabbits in the garden because the dogs are there. So, you know, those types of things may help you too. Mm-hmm. But there are, you know, and there are also some things that you can spray the plant with that make it bitter to their taste, you know, the deer and rabbit repellent. But the problem with that, with the annuals, is every time a new leaf grows, it doesn't have the repellent on it. So,
right.
Okay?
Okay, my second question is clematis. How hard are they to transplant?
If you do it at the right time of the year, which is early spring before they start to grow a lot, you can actually treat a clematis very much like a perennial and dig part of it out, or, you know, if you want to leave some of it there. If you want to move it completely, just dig it out and take as much soil as you can with it and then transplant it. But I think the best time to do it would be in the early spring. And if you know that it's something that you're going to do that, maybe it'd be a good idea right now to take a shovel and to dig around the plant. Go in the depth of the shovel right around the plant where you're going to dig it, because what'll happen then, especially if it's an older clematis, is that it will start growing new roots in that root ball area by severing some of the old roots on the outside. And then when you dig it, you'll have some of the new feeder roots around the plant.
Oh, okay. Also, with them, when should they be cut down, if at all?
In most cases, what I tell people to do with clematis is, although you get some dieback in the vines, most of the vines will stay alive through the winter. And so the only time I really tell them to trim them back is when you get so much dead material in the top of the plant that it starts to look pretty bad. Then you want to, you know, prune them back to maybe a foot and a half or 2 feet from the ground and just clean all that dead wood out and start over again.
Okay, so if I transplant these in the spring, should I leave? How much vine should I leave when I go to transplant them?
I would say probably a foot.
Okay.
Cut them off a foot above where you're digging, and that way you've got some buds for that plant to grow from. And then what I would do, too, is make sure they have a sweet soil, because lilacs, clematis, and a few others like a sweet soil. So you just put a cup full of lime, and mix it into the soil that you put around the plant when you put it back in, and your clematis will love it.
Okay.
All right, Irma, thank you very much for your call. And on to Anthony in Wausau. Anthony, what's on your mind today?
Yes. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Hey, I'm a first-time caller. I enjoy your show, and I just had to call. Earlier, you had talked about the tart pie cherry.
Yes.
And I'm thinking of planting a couple of cherry trees and a couple of plum trees in my yard.
Okay.
What I'm looking at is, you had mentioned a self-pollinating cherry tree.
Yep, self-fruitful,
I thought you had said Meteor was the species?
Yep, Meteor, Montmorency, and North Star are the self-fruitful ones.
Okay, which would you recommend for me? I intend to, again, I'd like to get them potted and plant next spring, something good and hearty, and just a couple of them.
Yeah, the Meteor is probably the best of the, it's the largest fruited of the tart cherries, and it's probably the largest tree, too.
Okay, very good. And I can go with two of those without a problem?
Yes.
Okay,
yep.
And then what about plums? I want to plant two plum trees as well. Are they self-pollinating as well, or do I need different types?
Okay, it depends on the plum that you're planting. If you want an American plum, what you want to do is plant the pipestone, but you also need a toca, or you need some wild plums in the area.
Okay? Pipestone is the name of the plum?
Pipestone is a variety of plum.
Okay, and the other one was what? And I don't have anything wild around.
Okay, so you want a toca, T-O-K-A. That's the pollinator variety for the American plums.
Okay,
now,
excellent.
If you want the European prune plum type, which is a very sweet plum. Mount Royal, and that you get smaller plums, but when they're ripe, you cut them in half. You can actually just dump the pit out because it's called a freestone plum, and they're very sweet. And that one is self-fruitful. That one you only have to plant one tree and you'll have fruit. So there's a difference between the American varieties and the European varieties.
And again, the European is Mount
Royal.
Mount Royal. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I do want two of them. Would you recommend the Mount Royal then as being the hardiest and the best for us here in the Wisconsin Wausau area?
Well, actually, there are two different kinds of plums. The Pipestone and Atoka are more like the large plums that you get in a store where the meat sticks to the pit, and the Mount Royal is one that the pit is loose in the thing. So the Mount Royal is definitely sweeter, but the others are probably real good too.
Good luck to you, Anthony, and we'll take more of your calls in just a moment after we check the latest news here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry's enjoying a day in Door County today after his successful remote broadcast from the Peninsula Players Theater. And this is a Garden Talk. With us is Dick Zondag, president of the Jung Seed Company in Randolph, Wisconsin, celebrating 101 or now 102 years in business, Dick.
Yeah. We're getting old, and I feel every day of it.
You feel every day of it. All right. Well, we'd be happy to take your questions and comments in Madison at 263-1890, toll-free at 800-642-1234, and, of course, our email address is talk@wpr.org. Mary in West Bend wondered, some of her potato plants are beginning to develop green potato-like buds at the top of the plant. What would be the cause of that?
What she's got to do is hill the plants up, because any potato that is exposed to sunlight, because it's a piece of stem tissue, will form chlorophyll, and that's not good to eat either. I mean, those potatoes probably should be discarded, I guess you'd say. But what you want to do, because potatoes tend to grow near the top, that's why you put them in real deep when mm-hmm. you start, and then you hill them up, because you want to keep the sunlight off from them. So I guess my recommendation to her would be to start hilling up soil around the potatoes so that you get, some people will get up to a foot of soil over the level of the soil, and that way when you pull the soil back and the potato vines die back so that the potatoes are mature, then you can dig them up and they don't have that green part on them. The green part is just chlorophyll that's forming because it's a part of stem tissue, and any part of a potato that's exposed to sunlight will do that.
On to the phones. Shirley in Marshfield is next. Hello, Shirley.
This is me.
This is you.
Yeah. I have a neighbor's backyard fence, and I would like to put some plants there because it's so difficult to mow on mm-hmm. my side.
Okay.
And I'm wondering, I would like to have something kind of tall.
Okay.
And
you looking for shrubs or perennials?
No, I'm looking for, well, it's something that will grow every year, of course.
Right.
Now, the one thing that I did see, and this is going to create some controversy, is, everybody gets hay fever. What the heck is that called now?
Goldenrod?
Goldenrod, yeah, goldenrod. Now, if I were to plant that, it's a beautiful plant.
It is.
If I were to cut the tops off before it could blossom and then spread the seed, would that be acceptable, do you think?
Well, the goldenrod problem is the pollen. And so if you cut the flower off, what would be the beauty of planting goldenrod? Because
I think the plant itself is very beautiful.
Okay.
It's tall,
yep.
And it has very graceful, beautiful leaves, and would go just great against a back fence.
Okay. One of the things that I would recommend, and that would probably work, first off, because you can't mow right up to it, I would put some kind of a lawn edging in that would create a border between the fence and where you're going to plant, so that you don't have to worry about mowing right up to the plants either. And there are a lot of ornamental grasses that get quite tall that would look very nice in there. There's a lot of Well, I guess what I would say is we've got a garden center in Stevens Point, and they have a lot of really nice grasses there. That would be one thing that you could plant. Siberian iris would be another thing. When they're not in bloom, they look like an ornamental grass, and they'll get about 2.5 feet high.
Oh.
Hollyhocks are quite large. You know, they get
quite
tall.
Yeah, we don't see those anymore.
And, you know, that would be another thing that would be sort of a perennial that would hide them. If you want to put a couple of shrubs in there so you have something there in the wintertime, the high bush cranberry would be one thing, or the Arrowwood viburnum. The red leaf plum is another one that would be very nice in that area. So you can do a sprinkling of both. You can put a couple of, you know, depending on the length of the fence, you could.
Can I just go back to the hollyhocks for 1 minute?
Sure.
It used to be back in my grandmother's day, we would gather the black seeds.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do they? I gathered some from somebody a year or two ago.
Right.
And they didn't seem to do anything.
Yeah,
are they so hybrid that they don't?
Well, it depends on the kind of hollyhock that you had. If it was a double hollyhock, those do not produce viable seed.
Okay.
If it's a single hollyhock, the seed is viable.
So if I were to buy a package of seeds from the supermarket and they were single, then they should reproduce?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, that's great news. Okay. Then this is another one you're going to laugh at me at. I was wondering about planting thistles around that fence, and then I cut off the blossom before they were able to spread because I've got rabbits coming in. And I was wondering if the rabbits would think, I've got enough of those pickery sickles.
I think thistle is a noxious weed, and you're not really supposed to plant those.
Yeah, I was afraid of that, yeah.
I'm pretty sure that...
Even though I cut off the
blossom. Yeah, I think Canada thistle is a noxious weed, which means that you're not really supposed to plant that particular...
Yeah, yeah.
Now, there are some Echinops, which is a type of thistle. It's another perennial that has blue flowers on it, where the seed is sterile. Those types of things. But I don't think that the thorny leaves will inhibit rabbits from coming in.
Those little dickens.
They'll slip right between them.
They're so cute at Easter time,
yeah.
Aren't they? Well, okay. Then I just heard somebody say something about, let's see here. Jesus, what the heck was that now? Well, I guess you've been very nice about this. I thought I heard somebody else say something that I thought was very interesting. I can't forget.
All right. Well, Shirley, thank you so much. Good luck to you. And on to Rose in Gilman next. Hello, Rose.
Hi. We've got an electrical storm up here, so I can't hear real well right now. But I have a question about blueberry bushes that we've had for like 40 years.
Okay.
And they're like 8 foot tall.
Okay.
And every year we keep losing more of the branches. Now, is this because it's just that old?
Yes, it's old age. What I would suggest is just like any other deciduous plant, if you want to start it over again, what you do is take about a third of the oldest stems off near the ground. And what you'll find is that the stumps that are there or even below the stumps, it will start shooting out new branches. And then next spring or after they fruit, I guess that would be better because they're fruiting right now. You wouldn't want to give that up. But then after they fruit, take out another third. And then the last year, and you could actually maybe even take them all out if you get a lot of little sprouts near the ground. That would be the biggest thing, to make sure that it's sprouting near the ground, but that way you could start to plant over. And then I'd give them a shot of muriacid and then acidify the soil again with some soil sulfur to get them to grow.
And Rose, thank you so much. Good luck to you with that rainstorm. You could hear the lightning in the background. Barb in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Barb.
Hi. I have two questions, but first I'd like to clear up a misconception. You guys were just talking about goldenrod. Goldenrod does not cause hay fever. Goldenrod is insect-pollinated. It's ragweed, which blooms at the same time and is in a weed in everybody's alley. Ragweed is what causes hay fever, not goldenrod.
Okay.
Goldenrod's very important for our butterflies and our bees this time of year as a food source. Please don't cut the heads off. I had two questions. One was, I have a river birch, which is experiencing chloriosis.
Chloriosis.
And I've been trying to spray it with, like, miracid and put coffee grounds around the roots, and I don't know what else to do for it.
Soil sulfur. The problem with river birch is that they grow mainly in the river bottoms where they have a little more acidic soil than what we have. And when the soil is too basic, they can't take up the iron and the manganese. So I'd get some soil, get a bag of soil sulfur, and kind of spread that at the drip line of the tree and work it into the soil, and then get some evergreen fertilizer. I mean, the muriacid should be helping a little bit because that has the iron and manganese in, but not only spray it on the leaves, but put it at the drip line of the tree, and that should help.
Okay. Then my other question was, my broccoli and cauliflower seem to be done for the year.
Okay.
But what's a good crop to follow that with, vegetables?
Some half-long carrots, radishes. Boy, I think beans right now, it's a little bit late to plant those. But, you know, radishes will be, will work in a matter of weeks. And if you put in some of the half-long carrots, that will work. And actually, although I'm not positive that cauliflower will work, if you plant cauliflower around the 4th of July for a fall crop, they make beautiful heads. So I have a spot in my garden, and I was thinking last night, I should get some cauliflower seeds and just see how late you can plant them and still get a head out of them. But I think cauliflower, if you get an early variety, would still make it for, at least medium-sized heads. I've seen some huge heads when they're planted around the 4th of July. So many of the cool season crops, maybe even some early cabbage, would still make it.
And it's all right to plant more coal crops where I just had coal crops?
That's sure. No problem. Yep. Unless the coal crops had problems of their own, then it was not a problem.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Barb. Appreciate hearing from you. Telephone number for you in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, toll free at 800-642-1234 as we talk with Dick Zondag on Garden Talk. Let's go to Mary in West Bend. Hi, Mary.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm doing a follow-up. I sent the email question about the potatoes.
Okay.
Our green growths are really little knobs at the top end of the plant, sort of where the blossom was.
Oh, that's the seed pods.
And so should we be, this is a couple of us at our community garden site are having this problem. Should we be cutting those off so that they put more energy into the tubers themselves?
Yep. See, what you're doing when you're planting a potato is you are vegetatively producing it so that you have a potato that looks exactly the same as the potato that you planted. If you were to use let those black or those green knobs mature, you would have potato seeds. And that's what they use when they hybridize to get new varieties. And there are a few varieties that you can plant from seeds, but they're actually robbing the carbohydrates that could be making your potatoes bigger. So when your potatoes blossom, if they're and there are probably bees in the area working the flowers so that they're pollinating, cross-pollinating them, and then they'll form the seed. So just cut those off because that's the seed pod.
All right, very good, and thank you so much.
All right, Mary, thank you for your call. Let's go to Betty in Camp Douglas next. And Betty, what can we do for you today?
Well, thank you for taking my call. First of all, are you with me?
Yes.
We are.
Yeah.
Okay. We had a disaster like a lot of people around here, our farmers were sad,
right. But
our garden was awash.
Mm-hmm.
And for so long, we couldn't even get out there, and we have raised gardens. So I didn't get peas in. I didn't get a lot of things in, but especially peas and beets. And I was wondering, what variety could I start at this time of year? I've got a note on my calendar, plant 60-day peas.
Right.
Now,
but the problem with peas is they're a cool season crop. They don't like the hot weather, so you may or may not have good luck with the peas.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe because they'd be maturing in cool weather.
You can try it. I mean, maybe it'd work. I've never tried planting peas in the hot part of the summer for a fall crop. That might work. I guess
could I try the sugar snap or the Dakota's a short-lived. Short.
Yeah, what I would use is a short season variety, the shortest maturity you can. On the beets, the Ruby Queen would be a good one.
Do you have that at your catalog?
Yes. In fact, you can either call up our number. The number is 1-800.
I have it. I've got the catalog right in front of me.
They can, I mean, we're processing orders on the day after the order comes in, so they would get them right out to you. The Ruby Queen would be the variety I would use, probably, or Red Cloud, one of those two. Now, what you may want to do, and I tried this year and had really good luck with my beets, is when the seed arrives, put it in some sterile mixer, some peat moss, and get the seed germinated before you put it in the ground.
Oh, good.
So that the rootlet is coming out of the seed, and then just spread it in the ground about a half an inch deep, and put the soil over top of it and water it in. They'll come up like gangbusters. I've got some really, you know, what happened, I guess the rains were part of my problem too this year, is that the seed packet that I was going to plant was sitting outside on the grass, and the packet got wet.
Oh, dear.
And so when the thing dried out a little bit, I saw that the seed was germinating. So I just made a furrow in the garden and put the seed in, and they're beautiful. They're just absolutely beautiful beets. Probably some of the best beets I've had. So maybe I've got a new system here. I don't know. But that pre-germinating the beet seed will get them out of the ground faster.
All right. And then I heard you talk one time about having carrots that you dug underneath the snow and dug up.
That's exactly right. You use the half-long type carrots.
Okay.
And then what you do in order to be able to dig them in the winter is you don't let the ground freeze before you mulch them. You're like late October, early November, put a 6-inch, well, maybe in a 10 or 12-inch layer of hay or straw over them.
Okay.
And that will keep the frost from getting in the ground. And then if we get good snow covers,
yeah,
you can dig them, and I did that with parsnips and with carrots, and they're really good. But you have to have a good snow cover too,
okay,
so that the frost doesn't go down real deep. And you mulch them when the soil is warm, and the reason you mulch is to keep the soil the way it is, and so that will do that. It'll keep the heat in the ground, and then when you get that snow over top, so that the extreme cold weather doesn't go into the ground, you can dig them all winter long.
Thank you. I have one little comment. Somebody was talking about having dogs to keep deer and so forth out of their garden.
That was me.
We have a dog, and my husband curries her regularly, so we've got a bag full of hair.
Mm-hmm.
We put it in bags, throw it around the garden, keeps the squirrels, the rabbits, and the deer away.
Yeah, if they see one of their predators, or they smell one of the predators, it tends to make them go to their neighbor's garden where
That's
there
right.
isn't that predatory smell.
All right. Thank you for your...
All right, Betty. Thank you. Appreciate hearing from you. Kurt in Cedarburg says he's trying to grow pumpkins in his backyard for the first time. The plants are getting a lot of blooms, but the flowers fall off after blooming. No pumpkins have started yet. Is there a specific reason for that?
Yeah, the pistil hasn't been fertilized. The cross-pollinating hasn't happened. The bees haven't been working. And with most pumpkins and squash, the first, I don't know, 3 to 6 buds will blast anyway. And so, you know, I guess when I'm talking to people about growing big pumpkins, the 5th to the 7th bud usually makes the biggest pumpkin. What you can do is take a paintbrush, you know, maybe a 1-inch paintbrush, and just go from blossom to blossom and open the blossom up so you get down into the pollen-producing area, and then just go from flower to flower, and that will set the seed, and then your pumpkins will start coming.
Very good. And Rose and Gilman, we lost you during that storm, and obviously you have more to say and ask about.
Yes, thank you for taking me again. I have a lot of lilies and the bearded irises.
Okay.
And they're not beside each other. They're, you know, like 75 feet away.
Right.
But the bearded irises, I've had a problem where they get the brown spots.
Okay.
And it just takes over the
whole plant. Yep, it's a bacterial leaf spot. And what you should do is when the leaves freeze back, probably in early to mid-November, go in with a knife or a pruning shears and cut them off and get rid of them, because that's where the initial inoculum for that disease overwinters.
So how low do I cut them?
Right down to the rhizome.
Okay.
You know, just take them off, even if they're a little bit green. Rake all the organic matter and everything that's in that area out and either compost it or get rid of it, and that will take care of the initial infection. The other thing you want to do is if your iris bed is quite thick, and right now is the time to do it. We're in the process of, in fact, this is the first day when we're digging iris to ship them this fall. Now is the time to thin the bed out. And just the same way you do any perennial, you dig half the clump out, and that way you get better ventilation so you don't have as much trouble with diseases.
Okay, will I have to spray them?
I would say right now, no. If you want to use a spray, probably the dormant spray in the springtime when the leaves first start to come out. Spray the ground and the plants to drip with a dormant spray, and that will help you with the initial infection. But by getting rid of all of the leaves and the organic matter, the old leaves that were there, that will remove the initial infection of that bacterium.
Okay, now you say a dormant spray.
Yep, oil and lime sulfur or dormant oil, or, you know, there are different preparations that we have of it. But it's something that you spray on the plant before the leaves start to grow.
Okay.
And it's kind of a house cleaning type thing.
Oh. Okay.
Mainly used on fruit trees, but can be used for problems like that on the iris also.
Okay. Now, could that also be a problem that's on a couple of my lilies, especially?
Oh, the Asiatic lilies?
Yes, where the leaves turned brown.
What you're seeing this year is with all the rain that we're having, a lot of the older leaves, the amount of nutrients that are being taken up are, what they're doing is they're robbing the lower leaves of many of the nutrients to make that flower grow. And so I don't think that it's a disease problem. I think it's just a environmental thing this year because of all the rain that we've had. Again, the situation there is to remove the, if it is a disease problem, as soon as the flower stalk dies back in the fall, cut it off and get rid of it. And that would take care of the inoculant that's there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
I know I do use Osmocote to fertilize in the spring right away.
Do you work it into the soil?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay, because if you put Osmocote on and you don't work it into the soil, it's pretty hot. You know, the plastic coating that keeps the nutrients from being readily available breaks down in sunlight. So if you're using Osmocote as a fertilizer on the soil, you got to work it into the soil so the sunlight doesn't get to it. Or what happens is the plastic breaks down and that very soluble plant food that's inside that little BB becomes immediately available and can burn the roots a little bit. So, you know, as long as you incorporate Osmocote into the soil and it's not just sitting on top of the plant in a pile, it's a great fertilizer.
In brief, what is the difference between red onions and yellow or white onions?
It's the genetics.
It's
the genetics. The red onions, although you can get some really sharp red onions, tend to be a milder onion. And then it just depends on the white onions. Most of the white onions are a lot milder, but the more sweet the onion is, for the most part, and it's, you know, all rules are have variance. But the more sweet the onion is, the less it will store.
Dick, thanks so much for being with us. Look forward to your next visit.
Thanks, Jim.
Dick Zondag, president of the Jung Seed Company, Randolph, Wisconsin. Their phone number at 800-247-5864. And the website, of course, jungseed.com. Larry Mueller's back on Monday. He'll be talking with Victoria Houston of Rhinelander about fishing and writing mysteries in northern Wisconsin. And the weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, will try to decipher the mysteries of our weather and climate here on the Ideas Network.